Welcome to our podcast From the Ground Up, where we interview startup founders exploring their journeys, their success, challenges, and lessons learned. We hope you'll be inspired in discovering what it takes to build a thriving startup. I'm your host, Jake Aaron Villarreal, and here today to talk with Martins Bratuskins, or rather Martins Bratuskins. I think I'm saying that right.
Yeah, that's correct.
Founder of Monetizer, a tech stars funded startup, which has raised $4.5 million in funding. Martins, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Jake. Very excited.
Great. Let me give you a little background on Martins. Martins is the founder and COO of Monetizer. He plays a leading role in the company, helping to move the operations to the U.S., onboarding major game studio customers. They recently raised $4.5 million in funding, and their product helps enable game publishers to create new revenue streams. So Martins, we're going to dive into your company and the problem it solves, and we'll get into a lot of that. But before we get started, tell us a little bit about where you're currently located and how did you get into the startup world?
Yeah, great question. So I'm originally from Riga, Latvia. It's a small country in Northeast Europe. I grew up here and I studied both here and then in Germany for a while. And then, I was working. I studied civil engineering, funny enough. So civil engineering, for some reason, I always felt like I want to build stuff. And that was kind of my passion and still is. And that's why I figured, hey, let me study civil engineering because that will enable me to build stuff. I started working for a very nice company in that space here. But very quickly I realized that that's not exactly what I want to do. And then I was there for less than 2 years. And then somehow I started going to these, startup hackathons, like these 48 hour events where, you come, a couple of people, join together in a team, build something within 48 hours. And, the first one that I went to was a total disaster. I was like, totally didn't work out. But then I went to a couple more, and then eventually that was what I needed to start my startup journey in the early days.
Yeah, that's great. So civil engineering to computer science. Did you actually learn how to code in school or learn it on your own?
Actually, I don't know how to code. My bachelor's degree says that I'm a bridge and road engineer. Actually, like that kind of a engineer. So I'm not a coder myself, but I have learned, at least in the early days, I spent a lot of time like trying to understand what is needed to run a startup. And of course, like a tech startup needs tech capabilities and then programming and stuff like that. So I feel like I understand enough to be able to speak with developers, speak with technical people. But at the same time, of course, if it gets too deep, then I'm probably not the right person to have that conversation.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, I think it's important, as a COO, you don't need to know how to code. You just have to understand the operations and the company and the strategy and a lot of other aspects that go into a startup. Riga is a place that I've also been to. I did a world travel with a backpack and a laptop and a camera and a notebook and just went solo for a year, which was an incredible experience. But one of my best experiences was in your hometown. I had met up with some random tourists and we just went around the country, had a blast. And what a great part of Europe. I love that area. The Baltic states are incredible. So you're the first startup that we've had on the show that's from that part of the world, and excited to hear the globalization of kind of where you started and how you distributed to the US and different parts of the world. But we'll get there.
Yeah.
In terms of the company you're at today, Monetizer, before this, did you start other companies or was this your first experience?
I would say this is my like a second startup. And then of course I've worked in various companies, before, but, this is my second startup. The first one was a big failure. I made basically made all the mistakes in the book, like everything. So I feel like that was a very good experience to have. But yeah, essentially, not to say that we haven't made mistakes also here, but at least I
Right.
feel like that was my first crash course, and then this is my second.
Gotcha. Well, you learn from your mistakes, and sometimes that's the best experience you can get, so you can apply that to the new companies you join. Now, when you started Monetizer, which was launched in 2016, we say a startup, but funding and growing, really, a startup to me is a company that's still evolving. So when you started, I think you have an interesting story. Correct me if I'm wrong. You left your paying job with your co-founders to start Monetizer. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. Yes, we knew that we want to do something together. We built prototypes with with no code solutions back in the day, and I remember those were Zapier and If This Then That and Shopify and various services that we could kind of plug together and create a piece of a product. And then we actually we in the very early days we were testing various market segments. Our idea was essentially that we will help mobile game publishers to monetize their games through merchandise sales, kind of like creating custom merchandise for both big and small publishers, because that was something that was usually available for very successful game publishers, big IPs, but not for smaller ones or middle tier. So we that was our first business model that we decided to tackle, and then to and we applied to various startup incubators, accelerators in the US. We knew that we wanted to go to the US, and for a while there, I remember it was like, hey, it doesn't look promising. But somehow, yeah, we didn't lose hope, and sooner or later, essentially we started having these conversations, and I remember that there was this one ex like a s relatively small accelerator like in Cincinnati, Ohio, that we really bonded with the managing director there, and I would say that he's probably the one big reason why Monetizer exists today, because he somehow believed in us, and he said, hey guys, it seems that you're onto something. We have this program here. Come here. And that's how we got to Cincinnati, Ohio.
Interesting. Now, was that part of TechStars or was that something different?
That was something different. That program is called UpTech Ideas. Yeah, they're based out of Cincinnati. We had a couple of offers, but somehow we prioritized this relationship. We felt like, hey, this guy gets us. We need to go there because relationships have and are very have been and still are very, very important in our day-to-day life. Yeah, we went to Cincinnati and spent like a little bit more than a year there. And it's just like funny how this whole thing comes around, because back then I remember we were like essentially doing a gaming startup. And many people, like pretty much everyone that we met in Cincinnati through the mentorship programs and through like various other activities, everyone was like, hey, but why Cincinnati? It's like, it's not a gaming place. It's like, it's a weird choice for a couple of Latvians to go to Cincinnati, Ohio to start a gaming company. And they're correct. That was a, like, I mean, somehow a coincidence. But like after now just like, okay, there's plenty of stuff in between that we'll get into. But now our biggest client is based in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is Procter and Gamble. They're headquartered there. So it's just like somehow comes this whole thing comes around.
Yeah, they say proximity sometimes is the most valuable aspect of a company. If you're in Silicon Valley, it might be access to investors. If it's the Midwest, it could be, you're in the automotive industry. It depends on where you're located in the world. But that's great. You've made those connections and the network I know is important. Walk me through the initial idea about Monetizer, where it was at, and then where it's at today. And if you made a pivot, what that looked like, because we work with a lot of startups and I don't think there's one that hasn't gone through some form of a pivot that's transformed who they are and what they do today versus when they started.
Great question. Yes. So like I explained before, so our first business model was essentially we were going to help game publishers monetize their games, hence Monetizer, through custom game branded merchandise products that we would automate the production and kind of do that part. And that was our, yeah, that was our business model. We, that was when we were, went to Cincinnati, and also when we then a little bit later joined Techstars and moved down to Atlanta, Georgia. That was our business model. We onboarded actually quite a few game publishers on the, onto our product, which was, like integrated into their games. We made an SDK, the software development kit for iOS, Android, and for Unity. That game publishers could integrate. Our product was made for game publishers to make more money from their existing user base by offering them exclusive limited edition merchandise products that they could buy directly from the game. So that was the business model. We tried, I mean, there's plenty of things that we tried within that business model. And it did work with those publishers that had that created a very deep integration with the game, and where the products were like exclusive and they were unlockable after you reached a certain level. So it had this level of exclusivity to them. Some publishers did like these like limited edition merchandise products, like T-shirts with a specific design that maybe had like a specific number printed on the back here that said, hey, you own the t-shirt number, I know, 57 out of 100, this design, things like that. That worked, and the sales results and the conversion results were good for those publishers who did that deep integration. But the problem that we always had was that this only addressed this addressed the super fans of the game. You know, like the in the gaming space, they're called whales. Like these people who are, you know, spend lots of time and lots of money within that game. And the problem was that for game publishers, even especially for the bigger ones, it was almost never priority number one to integrate a solution that only serves like a, I don't know, top 1% of their audience. Yes, a very important audience, but, you know, there's a 99% of the audience that this solution doesn't really help or monetize. And that was, yeah, we struggled with this with the, for a while because we had these mixed signals like, hey, everyone wanted to do that. Everyone wanted to be like Angry Birds with like a big gaming brand and have like swag and stuff. But when it came to actual integration and dedicating your developer resources to make the integration, which was easy, but still, you know, we needed that needed to be done. It was never a priority. And that was for us as a company, it was just like heartbreaking all the time. Like these mixed signals. Hey, we really want to do it, but not now. We really want to do it, but not now. And I feel like, you know, we were also telling ourselves that no, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. But, eventually, we just realized that it's something that unless we figure out how to address a bigger part of the audience, not just like the top 1 or 2% of the player base, but something closer to 100%, we realized it's probably not going to be a priority for any big publisher. So, and that's the thinking that led us to the pivot that we eventually did in 2020.
So just to clear that up, you had a nice to have product, but not a need to have product. And within that scope of that game publisher, it was for them an ability to raise or build revenue into their platform or their application, their game. But you were actually shipping a product in the process of a t-shirt or something that was connected to that game for their fans that would buy it online and you guys would generate revenue out of that model. But then that at some point didn't quite hit the levels you needed or wanted. And so then you made a change.
Yeah. That's correct. And I mean, I still believe that there's plenty of games that would really benefit from that model. Because
I love that model.
We had created like I remember there were a couple of these very, very high class game developers. Like one of them also had just gotten an Apple Design Award. Like Apple does these essentially for the best app of the year or game of the year kind of awards every year. And they had just gotten that one, and they were very picky, like very this perfectionist type. And they had integrated our product in such a nice way. Essentially, they showed us the way how it's supposed to work. And that was so nice. And we're like, hey, yes, there's these people that get us. And then actually the sales in those games were very good. But yeah, we just realized that these bigger publishers who look at their game economy more from a, hey, but just a pure numbers perspective, it was never going to be a priority because it was a nice to have. It was like, hey, we can always make, I don't know, like a web store somewhere outside of the game that would just be quicker and other people could do it and stuff like that. And that feature of having it inside the game and having the possibility to pay with Apple Pay or Google Pay right within the game without leaving it was just like not as important for them.
Got it. So talk about the new revenue model, the new product that you pivoted to. And when you talk about a pivot, what goes into that? I mean, how some people talk about a pivot, but it's really just a language change of how they're presenting their product into a different audience. But sometimes it's actually rebuilding a new product or integrating new technology that you didn't have before. What was the pivot like for you, and what did that include?
So from the very early days, I remember when we got accepted to Techstars, we were, they do this great job of matching each company together with various mentors from the ecosystem. And they did that also for us. So I'm very, very happy and grateful for that. That my network is still great and we still keep in touch with all of the people. So it's great. But I remember that when we were pitching that first business model, this merchandise business model to them, one thing that kept coming up and again and again and again was that, hey, you guys essentially have built a product, you have built an integration into these games that has a certain amount of audience, but you're only monetizing the top 1 or 2%. So like I said before, and there's like 98% that you don't address, right? Like what's up with that? And it just happened to be that many of our mentors were coming from a marketing background, especially that was in Atlanta. So many had worked for Coca-Cola or Home Depot or Delta or, one of the big companies down there. And yeah, so they were always kind of like nudging us to explore that marketing aspect of our product, that hey, you have this audience, you have access to this audience, but you're not doing anything to it. I mean, there's plenty of brands that are trying to get into gaming and trying to reach that audience. So why don't you do that for them? That was thing number one. And then thing number two was I remember we had from time to time we went to these gaming conferences, and I very vividly remember that the one in Helsinki, Finland. Where we met the people from Saibo, and Saibo is the company that makes a game called Subway Surfers. Subway Surfers is the most downloaded mobile game of all time on the mobile devices. And I
Wild.
remember talking to them and also pitching that merchandise product, and also them saying like, "Hey, we have from time to time we have these like big and small brands reach out to us and want to kind of somehow integrate into the game." I mean, you have their pro like some kind of products inside the game, but why not make them the branded product? And that was like a light bulb moment for us, for my co-founder and I. We were like, hey, this is exactly what the mentors have been telling us to explore. And this is now one of the largest game publishers in the world telling us that that's something that they might be interested in. So that was that light bulb moment when we took a really deep look into, hey, this old business model, it's not scaling or not working as well as we expected. Maybe it's time for a change because like we needed to do something. And then this conference in Helsinki, that was a Pocket Gamer Helsinki conference, I think in 2020, late 2020, when we were like, okay, I feel like now is the time.
Yeah. So Procter and Gamble, you mentioned, is a client. What's the use case for them, and what specifically do you do with them, and why gaming for them? Walk me through that use case so that it's clear to the listeners of how your model works today.
So essentially, our product is so right now, Monetizer is an ad tech product where we have two sides of the marketplace. One is the advertisers, like the big brands, the CPGs, the Procter and Gambles of the world, and the other side are game publishers. And our product sits between both of them. So right now, what we do is we go and we sell to the CPGs of the world, like Procter and Gamble brands. We sell these in-game activations, and then our product is integrated into many, many game publishers. And now we also have the big ones that we couldn't get across the finish line before, like Voodoo and Tap Nation, and like those very, very big ones. And on the game publisher side, it is a new revenue stream for them. But how it actually works? What's the big difference between what Monetizer does and what typical in-game advertising looks like? That's the question that brands always ask me. And the big question is that there's a couple, I think like the timing is now when big brands are understanding and starting to realize that gaming is a media channel. For a very long time, they were kind of writing it off and saying that, hey, this is just like for teenage boys in their basements and yada, yada, yada. Something like that. That was definitely an assumption that many people had before. And then somehow COVID hit. And gaming, if I'm not sure if you remember, but like in the media, everyone was going down, but like gaming was that one thing that now it was clear that, okay, that is picking up, right? And then I feel like that was that moment, that shift mindset, mind shift, like change and shift for the brand owners and advertisers that, hey, this is a media channel. People are using it, not only teenage boys, but everyone's using it. And that data proves it. Like the average gamer is like 38 years old, and like the median income is like, I think like 60 something thousand dollars. So it's not your stereotypical gamer. So what we offer for brands like P&G, we offer this reach of Gen Z and millennial audiences inside a network of mobile video games. And the format is our format is a multi-touch format, so that it's not a one ad that pops up somewhere in the gameplay, right? That is just like the one that when it pops up, then you wait for that X to show up. That's the typical in-game advertising experience. And we were like, okay, no, that's not the experience that we want, because we've built games and apps before, and that's like a necessary evil almost. So we asked ourselves, how can we, hey, here's this brand that wants to reach and engage with these gamers. How can we make it so that the brand helps players instead of annoys players? So what we did is we created these opt-in formats where the player can choose to play with the brand. There's like a this pop-up button that shows up somewhere on the main screen of the game once the campaign is activated. Then if the player chooses to opt in and engage, then they click on that button. And then this branded offer wall shows up where there's let's say the brand a banner and then various objectives that the player can complete and get branded rewards. Those objectives include branded mini games, quizzes, surveys, also branded videos, things like that. Once the player completes any one of those objectives, they receive an in-game reward. Or also in some cases we also offer branded coupons. Let's say you get X amount of dollars off something. So that's essentially the flow. The players can choose to opt in with the brand, play the branded experience, and get a branded reward inside the game. That's what we do now.
That's great. How big is the market?
I mean, right now it's the game advertising market right now sits around I believe like it's 170 or something billion dollars right now. But almost none
Crazy.
of that is typical brands, right? Like the it's a very, very small percentage of that budget is actually spent by you know, brands, advertisers. Most of that money is spent within the industry of one game publisher advertising in another game, right? Like so that they can get users from one game to another. Hey, you make a new game, you advertise in other games to get users to your game. And that's something that game publishers are not very keen on, but that's like a necessary evil that they do. But where's the opportunity is that these CPG brands and these, you know, big advertisers, they don't necessarily want to take players away from the game. They just want to engage with the players, give them some value so that they can build relationships with those players. And that's where we come in, where essentially we enable these big advertisers to place their interactive experiences inside existing video games at scale, so that players can engage and get rewards from specific brands that they like. And from a budget, like from a market and a business perspective, I feel like there's a huge opportunity for growth because these big brands have not really advertised in games in a meaningful way before. So I feel like that is a blue ocean opportunity to enable them to buy these experiences at scale.
So the business model now is that advertisers are spending money with the publishers who are making revenue off of where they're placing those ads, and you guys get a percentage based on having the marketplace platform.
Yeah, we do a rev share with the publishers. So our pitch to the game publishers is, hey, we will be your brand sales team, essentially. You know, you can, like the big, big, big publishers, they have their own brand sales teams, but the vast majority of publishers, even very big ones, don't. And it's a new, totally different area that they have to hire new roles for, and it's expensive, and it's just something that they can do, but it's difficult. But if we partner with them, we essentially become their sales team. We go to these big brands, we say, hey, we have inventory, like let's say in the US, we have approximately 78 million monthly active users that we can reach within the US only. And yeah, that's how it works.
That's great. So it takes effort to do that. How big is the team? Where are you located today as an organization? Are you global? Are you European?
Right now we are 10 people full time plus I think like 4 freelancers, all like part time employees essentially. So not that big yet from a team perspective. Where we're based, we have people in the US, we have people in the UK, in Finland, in Latvia. So we're pretty distributed. Yeah.
That's great. You know, the idea of a product is kind of one part of the business, but getting the right people is critically important. I mean, it's really the magic behind the company and the resourcefulness, the intellect behind what you're creating, you're building, and ultimately trying to scale. What have you learned about hiring? What are some of the insights that you can share with the audience that you've optimized that work for you?
Hiring, I feel like that's the area where we're learning so much. And we've made, again, so many textbook mistakes in regards to hiring that's a tough one. But I feel like the main learnings for us has been that we should hire people who are, first of all, we should strive for A-plus players. So if we don't feel like that person is an A-plus player, then sometimes it's a very hard no, because, hey, you need that position. You need someone to do that job. And you're like, hey, here's a candidate. I mean, they're kind of good. They're technically good at this and this and that. But I mean, if you don't have that hell yeah feeling, then
yeah,
it has always resulted in us losing time, losing money, and eventually not working out with that person anyways. So it's like, what we try to do now is we try to hire based on this. Of course, like we, you know, we have a process. We actually follow the, there's a book, The Who, which talks about the hiring process and like very specifically details what kind of interview questions to ask and how to organize that process. We try to follow that process in the hiring part of things. And then, only if the player, we really, after all those questions, we feel like that person is an A-plus player, then we will go forward with them. And so that's the hiring part. Then once that person is onboarded, then we set out very clear objectives and key results that we want together. We work on them together with that person that we want to hit within the first 90 days. And the 90-day mark is also the mark where, of course, we will know whether or not we hit those objectives that we set out in the beginning. But also, we let the whole team vote anonymously whether or not they feel like, hey, this is an A-plus player that you want to work with. And then that's something that we learned that we somehow need to do because, again, we had mistakes where we hired some people that were somehow very nice to the founders, but not that very nice to other people. And especially when you're working remote, sometimes you don't catch that. It's very difficult to catch those interactions. And then you start getting these mixed signals from people like, hey, what's up with that person? And you're like, what? No, everything's fine. So like these kind of things, we learned that we should be very picky. We should be really, really picky. We should be demanding in terms of results, and we also should be taking all the team's opinion into account when deciding who to work with or who to continue work with, because that I feel like we've made very many mistakes in all of these areas and trying to improve.
Yeah. You know, it's one of the things that I think every company goes through. There's multiple playbooks of how to do it, but when you actually have to make a decision on a person, there's different aspects of that decision. It's emotions, connection, relationship, you know, they do enough, maybe not as much as you want. So let me hold on to them. And ultimately you want to, sometimes it's not who you hire, but who you fire that helps your company grow. So exactly. That's what we've seen. When COVID hit, it was everyone went remote. They had to and distribute. And, you know, a lot of companies have kept that mentality. Like they love being remote and distributed and it's working for them. We had to pivot as well. And we started working with companies in the US and we started working with companies internationally. And, you know, all of a sudden in San Francisco, you could hire out of Brazil or you're in Canada, you could hire from Argentina. And so the world in a lot of ways got smaller, which was great. For our business, which is recruitment. But, you know, we also learned a lot. And one of the things that we learned was that companies that are startups that are local in one country but want to grow in another country oftentimes don't have the person in place that understands the compliance of how to hire in a certain country from state to state. So there's this growth around fractional HR people or fractional CFOs, which we, as our pivot, had to implement into our services. So now we're seeing a lot of companies for a fraction of the cost being able to, you know, hire without having to think about the headaches. And it's been really interesting to see innovation come out of it from not just a product perspective, but services and ultimately helping companies get off the ground without the high cost, which I think is important to kind of look at. So the company today, you're distributed, you're in multiple countries. What's next for your organization? Is it just about, you know, continuing to sell and get product placements in place for your publishers? What's kind of next on the innovation roadmap?
So we have, that's one of the things where I've learned over these years that our team is very creative. We love to build stuff. So the key is actually, again, saying no to like 99% of the initiatives, which is very hard because, you know, people are excited. They're like, hey, I had this great idea and blah, blah, blah. And it could fit this and that and that. And then we could get another niche or like another type of client on board and blah, 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 which is, and I love that, you know, like that's initiative. That's this these stars in people's eyes, and like people are really, really passionate about these things. And it kind of kills me that I need to be that one of the people that kind of shut most of it down, because then we just lose focus. And we've lost focus before, and I've seen so many founders and like fellow founders who essentially lose the business and they go bankrupt because they are just like, without hitting product market fit, they lose focus and they start doing too many things at the same time, and then it all doesn't work out. So yeah, saying no to things is a hard thing, especially when like definitely 9 out of 10 answers is a no. That's even harder. Yeah, but regarding the next steps of the company, our big next step is to grow the number of enterprise clients that we have. Our goal is to get to 5 companies, these kind of multi-billion dollar advertisers, CPG companies first. First, we are really right now for the next at least 6 months, definitely, we are focusing on the CPG category only. And then we are going to run these tests with the quick serve restaurant category as well, where because we've seen like some good insights from those businesses as well. And then a couple of other verticals, but essentially go vertical. What we want to do is go and grow vertical by vertical, and of course keeping in mind that that we have to kind of move in lockstep. We have a sales demand sales team, meaning the team that sells to brands, advertisers, that gets the money in, and then we have the game publisher sales team, who are bringing on board new publishers and making sure that we have enough inventory to meet the demands. And this is kind of a thing where we can't, it's a chicken and egg problem, and we can't get a very huge big advertiser without making a big leap also on the publisher side. So kind of like balancing those and making sure that we are continuously, as we're scaling up, continuously delivering the value for publishers and the fill rates for publishers, and also being able to grow the inventory for brands. Because those big brands, once they start scaling up, they are by scale, they really mean scale. It's not some like, hey, let me increase like some 10% here or 5% there. No, it's like 10x things, and 10xing things or 100xing things over a very short period of time. It's difficult. So that's one big challenge that we're facing right now, actually.
Yeah, got it. That's great. Well, sounds like you got some good opportunities to work on and as you build the company. Monetizer, spelled Monetzr, is a great company. Martins, if someone wants to find you or the company, how would they do that? Where should they go?
Yeah, so they could just go to our website, themonetizer.com, themonetizer.com. And there's my contact information on there. There's a chat, web chat as well there. So that's option number one. People can also find me on LinkedIn and all the other social media networks. Yeah, many, many people. I try to be very active on LinkedIn. So if you have any questions about the I don't know the do's and don'ts of startups that where I can help, or some kind of network where I can help, please reach out. I'm very happy to help any founder to also brainstorm about their business ideas or things that are not working, trying to figure things out. Like I said, I love to build things. I love that community of founders of both tech stars, but also like bigger than tech stars, not just tech stars network. I love the being among the community and trying to really help other people reach their goals. And like I personally, I get excited when I see that people are really excited. So please don't hesitate to reach out, and I'll do my best to help you.
Great. Well, Martins, thanks so much for joining here. We interact with 100,000 engineers a year. So if you are interested at some level, and Monetizer seems interesting to you, feel free to reach out to Martins. Thank you so much for your time, Martins, for joining us today, and for our listeners for listening. It means the world to me and to our company. And until we catch up in the future, Martins, we'll see you down the road, hopefully soon, and hear your progress. And to all of our listeners, we'll see you on the next episode. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you so much, Jake. It was a pleasure to be here.
All right. Thank you. Before we wrap up, I want to give a big shout out to all the entrepreneurs that have joined to make this podcast possible. And for all the listeners for listening, it means the world to me that you chose to spend your time with us today. I'm your host, Jake Aaron Villarreal, signing off for now, but can't wait to connect with you all soon on the next episode. Take care. This show is sponsored by Match Relevant, a company that helps venture-backed startups find the best people in the market, and they do it in three simple steps. First, they sit down with founders to understand their story. Second, they tell their story into multiple candidate channels. And third, they schedule interviews within 48 hours. Find us at matchrelevant.com to learn more about how we do it.